If I go into a room of supervisors and I do this whole distribution chart up to where we are now, and I ask them, where do they spend their time? They all point to the low performers.
Right.
That's fine. We talk through that. And then I ask them, why aren't you spending time with high performers?
And welcome back to the podcast, folks. Bill Sheridan here. And if, as you know, if you've been listening to this podcast for any amount of time, we spend a lot of time here talking about the future. Yeah, I mean, duh, right? The podcast name is Future Proof. But when it comes to the future, we've been focusing on things like trends, strategies, visions, resources, regulations, skills and competencies, business models. You know what's missing from that list? People. And people, I mean, let's face it, they might be the most important factor in all of these future-ready conversations because they're the ones who are going to make all that stuff happen. So as we work to make ourselves and our organizations more future-ready, I think one of our first steps has to be figuring out how to surround ourselves with great people. We won't be able to achieve any of this stuff unless we have great people working on it with us. So I'm grateful to have my friend Carl Ulrichs on the show today. Carl has years of experience in human resources and operations, diversity and inclusion, pretty much any people issues in business management today. And he has some very specific ideas about how we can work to build productive, resilient workforces that are made up of great people, people who are high performers and great fits culturally. I mean, it's that old Jim Collins litmus test, right? You need the right people in the right seats. And the best definitions I've heard of those two qualities come from a book called Traction. It's written by a business coach named Gino Wickman, who describes it this way. He says, right people are people who are good cultural fits for your organization. They embrace your values and culture. Right seats simply means they have the ability and acquired skills to do their jobs extraordinarily well. And if all of your people have both of those characteristics, they'll take you wherever you need to go. Except an exception to every rule, right? Carl places an asterisk next to the right people description. He says surrounding yourself with people who just blindly follow the cultural lead may leave you without the diversity of thought that is so crucial these days. Still, I think it's possible to have a diverse workforce without doing damage to your culture. Not only possible, I think it's absolutely necessary. And not only that, but Carl says it's possible to develop a set of core values that are embraced by every generation in your office. That in fact, there are a handful of values that resonate with every age group. And that getting these values right, that could be the answer to that age-old employee engagement dilemma. So good stuff here, important stuff too, because really when you think about it, everything boils down to our people. Get the people component of your business right, as Gino Wickman calls it. Get that right, and you've won most of the battle. So without further ado, here is Carl Ulrichs. Well, Carl, thanks for being here. And I'm glad you're here because this subject, I think, anyway, often gets overlooked, I think, when we talk about the future and becoming future ready, because people are at the heart of future readiness, right? I mean, if we don't surround ourselves with great people,
yep,
we're hurting our chances of being prepared for what's to come, don't we?
That's exactly right. And we often focus on the technology or the process side of things and kind of skip over the human side of things because it's tougher to control. It's tougher to quantify. How do you measure a culture? How do you, you know, when I say I've got a high-performing culture, a CFO or a CPA shrugs and says, that's soft, mushy language. How do you quantify that?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, let me jump to a quick answer there. What there's two indicators that are good. One is productivity, if you're measuring that. And the other, it's interesting from a high-performing culture standpoint, the customer experience scores, if you're measuring that, where everybody who touches a client contributes to a good customer experience. And if those scores are part of a metric, you can watch people who are engaged, people who will go the extra mile, people who are adaptable, flexible, resilient, will do magical things to just make that customer experience, the touch points, nice. And let's say you're at a firm, you're at an accounting firm, you're in the tax department. And you shrug and say, really, only a couple times a year do I touch the client. But those are crucial touches. If I'm standing up in front of 100 people and I ask, give me 3 or 4 organizations that you interact with that really get the customer experience correct. And I can predict the top 4 are going to be Nordstrom's, Chick-fil-A, Starbucks, and wait for it, Southwest Airlines. Well, what if the person who's coming in to drop off their forms, before they came to you, they picked up a latte mocha whip at Starbucks, they dropped some shoes off for exchange at Nordstrom's, and they guess where they had lunch? Chick-fil-A. And now they walk into your world. And is the customer experience being offered to par with what they've been spoiled with so far in the day? I would tell you that the tax department would have just as much chance to have a good customer experience as any of those others if they have a high-performing team. Right. So how do we get that and how do we keep that? I'm going to jump ahead to how do we keep that. We'll circle back to how do we get that after I make an important point. I figure I've still got a scrap of people's attention at this point in the podcast, so I might as well go to the punchline now.
Right.
You know, if Carl, what's the one thing? Okay, here's the one thing. It comes down to a distribution curve. And this is in my presentation on anticipating greatness, you know, how to do this. Do a standard distribution curve and you could map your existing team into that curve. There's high performers, there's low performers, and there's, let's say it's 20 people, because I can do the math. You've got 3 high performers, 14, let's call them good performers, mid-pack, and then there's 3 low performers. Well, which ones really affect the customer experience? It's the outliers. It's the high performers and the low performers. High performers in the sense that they have been measured to produce 60% of the goods, products, services, goodwill, all that stuff. Those 3 people deliver 60% of what the department delivers. And if you've managed, you know that's true. And then there's those other 3 who deliver a negative score. Negative 20%, let's say. So the mid-pack 14 performers, they deliver 60%. The high-performing 3 deliver 60%. Therefore, the low performers, not only do they not score anything, they have a negative 20 because they'll do something bonehead that costs you points. And here's a key point. All of the high performers know that the low performers are getting by with something, and it's demoralizing for them, takes the air out of the room for them. They hate it. And if the low performers are not being held accountable, not part of a performance plan, not working on getting their game up, well, it's really demotivating to the high performers.
Yep.
You with me so far?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, here's the scary thing. If I go into a room of supervisors and I do this whole distribution chart up to where we are now, and I ask them, where do they spend their time? They all point to the low performers.
Right.
That's fine. We talk through that. And then I ask them, why aren't you spending time with high performers? Well, Bill, why would, you know, let's say you're the manager. What would you tell me are the reasons you're not spending time with the high performers?
Go. I think my first answer would be, well, they don't need it. They're high performers. They're good at what they do. So why do I need to spend time with them?
Bingo. So let's agree then. We've got this population of crucial people who aren't getting much time with the boss. The boss thinks they're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to micromanage him. Okay, with the power vested in me by this fancy microphone, I declare, Bill, that you are a high performer.
Thank you.
What motivates you? Give me three or four things as a high performer that motivates you. Go.
Outside of compensation, I would say maybe even more than that would be recognition.
Okay, where does that come from?
That comes from your boss.
Right. The one that's not talking to you.
That's right.
Stretch assignments. Where do those come from? Mm-hmm. Challenge. Where do those come from?
Yep.
So high performers, can they get a different job in 30 days in this job market?
I would say almost certainly.
Okay. The chances are they could get a job closer to their home for more money in 30 days.
Yep.
So what's keeping them?
Right.
A relationship with a boss.
Yeah.
Here's my point. Figure out who your high performers are and get to know them. Talk with them daily. Briefly, figure out what the rules are, but figure out who they are and become an important part of their lives. If they are, well, here, let me give you a secret tip. I had the best boss ever that I stayed with far longer than the money indicated I should have. The cash, understand, to high performers, cash is a ticket to entry. But Bill, is cash a long-term motivator?
No.
So I stayed a lot longer than I should have because he knew who I was. And I watched him and he had a secret weapon. And I know that most of the people who are part of our world are relatively frugal.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a freebie. What he would do is he printed a spreadsheet every Monday morning and folded it and put it in his pocket. The spreadsheet had four columns. First column, name, 31 names. He managed 31 people.
Mm-hmm.
Second column, a cryptic code about how that person got information, processed it, communicated. He was real good at some assessment tools. So he might have had their DISC code there or their Myers-Briggs code there, or whether they were an orange or a yellow or a green or an otter or an eagle or whatever. Measurement, don't laugh, they exist.
I know.
Whatever assessment language he wanted to use, it could be English, you know, that this person is, they love structure and organization and just a code quick of how to talk. Okay, so that's the second column. Third column, personal interest. As a human, fly fishing, mom's dialysis, four grandchildren, dogs, whatever.
Imagine that.
Yeah. A quick note about what's on their front burner when they're off work. Fourth column was blank. He didn't go home on Friday until he had checked in the fourth column that he had had at least a 60-second interaction live with that person. Could be face-to-face, could be on the phone. A quick touch, a quick help, you know, hi, what's going on? And he would often, in the mix of asking about fly fishing or grandma, he would make eye contact and ask, is there anything I should know? He never got blindsided, and everyone felt they had a channel that they could, in a transparent, healthy way, they could say, nope, I'm good. Or they could say, I'm having an issue with that coworker.
Right.
Because if they don't have that, I teach a lot of harassment avoidance classes. If a hostile work environment suddenly pops up, toes get stepped on, something's going on, the high performer knows they are portable.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a choice. Either raise it, bring it up with their and trigger that process,
mm-hmm.
or just answer one of those LinkedIn inquiries.
Right, right.
Or one of those Indeed pings, and let's get out of here.
Yeah.
And in today's job market, that happens more often than not. And in the exit interview, if you have one, they lie to you and tell you it's the money.
Right, right.
Because they just want out of the room. They don't mm-hmm. want to hurt what happened. They just want out of the room.
Pretty powerful stuff there. I mean, when you're talking about engagement and making that connection, that's the human side of it goes way deeper than I think most people realize.
It's everything. Yeah. It's especially as we get a little personal maturity and some emotional intelligence, mm-hmm. which is just fancy talk for wisdom.
Right.
You know, it's really early in life, we're still keeping score and paying off student loan debts.
Mm-hmm.
We get midpoint in our careers. We've had a couple good ones and we've had a couple bad ones. We know the difference.
Right.
And that's when we can pivot and either leave or choose to stay.
Yeah.
And that makes all the difference. So we're about halfway through our discussion. That's one of my best points.
Yeah, that's a good one. So how do we learn to spot these great performers, these high performers early? Like, I don't know, even going back to the hiring process, for example, how do we smoke them out? How can we tell whether they're going to be a good fitter?
Let's agree that tasks are different and each task has a different, like a chord on a piano, for the kind of person that will do that task happily as a high performer.
Mm-hmm.
I was up in Baltimore. I rented a car at the airport, and I met a high performer who was perfect for his job. And he was antisocial, low energy, hated people.
Mm-hmm.
He was checking out is this really your rental car in the little booth in the parking garage?
Right.
And he had been trained to slide the little door open, briefly smile, and say, give me your ticket.
Uh-huh.
And don't trust anything that you're told. Check out, do they match? And when this other person, this irritating other person, moves on, they could then settle on their little metal stool and turn the Orioles game back up on their scratchy AM radio, and they were happy.
Right.
Come back in 20 years, they will still be there.
Mm-hmm.
My point is that every pot has a lid, as my grandma used to say. Every person has a fit for a position. And if you think high performance is a single model, it's by task. It could be by office. If your firm has multiple cities, the culture in Midtown Manhattan for that office is going to be different than the culture for rural Norfolk, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's going to be situational. And part of the magic of being a good manager is understanding matching people to their tasks. Everybody listening at some point has probably reassigned somebody and had them go from subpar to stellar.
Right.
Because now it fits.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, and the terrible thing is a lot of people who are desperate for benefits, desperate just for a paycheck, on the way in will say anything just to get hired.
Right.
And 91 days in, the real them emerges. And if it's not a fit, everybody's going to be miserable.
Oh, geez. Yeah, who is it? Thought leader I heard speak a while back by the name of Tim Sanders.
Oh, yeah.
He said, I think the way he put it was high-performing jerks will suck the life out of an organization. And I think he's absolutely right.
He is. No, that's really true. And a side note, if your firm, if you have kids or grandkids, you know that whatever behavior you tolerate, you're going to get more of.
Yep. Yep.
And if you're sending the message that somebody who brings in revenue is protected no matter how jerky they are, high performers under them aren't going to put up with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they will move. Let me jump to a quick indicator for people who are, you know, kind of glomming onto this. What should I watch for? Let's say let's set up a situation. You've got a firm with three departments. People in each department. Figure out first who the high performers are. Second, watch for the departures of high performers as opposed to the departures of anybody else.
Okay.
Because in general, low performers will grip their chairs even if it's nasty.
Right.
Watch the high performers. If you've got a department that in a year burns through four high performers, thumbs up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that something is probably the boss.
Yeah.
Or it could be a low performer that is causing a toxic environment that the boss isn't seeing.
Yep. Yep.
And your spider sense should be tingling. Watch the retention of high performers versus the it's kind of interesting. You have to bifurcate the group into high performers and low performers.
Right, right.
And have the turnover numbers tracked separately.
Mm-hmm.
If the low performers are leaving, that means your progressive discipline process is working.
Yep, yep. And this all seems to me to be leading kind of naturally to a conversation about core values. Which I think are some of the most important factors, in my opinion, when it comes to surrounding ourselves with great people, because ultimately we want to surround ourselves with people who believe what we believe, who are good fits culturally, don't we?
No.
Ah.
I used to think that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to have some values alignment, but I also think we need to have people who have a diversity of values, so that we've got lots of different thinking styles on the team. If we end up with, now let me back up a second. I want everybody in an accounting firm to share a common value for ethics and integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That one's not movable.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had a team where everybody valued exact punctuality, and everybody valued everything organized.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to have very many creative types on that team, are we?
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
So there's an asterisk. I want to push back a little bit on it. There are some values that are immovable.
Mm-hmm.
But if we end up, this is a new thing that's coming up in the talent management spheres, where a couple of years ago, everybody would have said, yes, we all want values alignment. They're finding that if we do that too firmly, we end up letting our hidden biases create a group of people that aren't very different from each other.
Right.
And homogeneous teams where everybody's pretty much the same, the data shows if they get a new, from we're talking resilience here,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that short term, their resilience is greater because they don't have to explain to each other what they're thinking.
Right. Right.
Long term, their sustainability is lower because they don't have it's not a nice salad bar. You go to a salad bar and there's crunchy bits and squishy bits and red things and yellow things, you know, and they all come together to make an interesting salad.
Right.
If we focus too much on one particular set of values and we want everybody to be like us, long term it works against you. Hmm. So there needs to be a balance. And now, big asterisk, everybody's got to be ethical. You know, everybody needs to do the right thing. But within that, we need some more wiggle room than... this is new data, by the way. This is what's coming our way.
Yeah. Sounds a little similar to something that another guest on the podcast told me not too long ago, Sally Hogshead, who was kind of referring to this notion that, you know, it's almost like self-awareness, right? So I know what I naturally excel at, and I may need someone else on the team who excels at something else. So it's
bingo.
It's being aware of what my shortcomings are and surrounding me with folks who can kind of fill those gaps.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Also, as we get to a much more diverse and inclusive workforce, we need more open-mindedness in this. Mm-hmm. I have visited firms that were wonderful, to use my metaphor from a minute ago, salad bar.
Mm-hmm.
And next door, everybody has been stamped out of one mold and are essentially interchangeable cogs in the machine.
Mm-hmm.
I would contend this latter model is not going to be sustainable long term.
Yeah.
I work at a firm that is 5 generations in the same ownership, 140 years old. And it's a salad bar and it's sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at our demographic pipeline, and in every position, we've got people that span the generations. I have never worked any place like this. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm describing is not theory. This is what a sustainable agency organization needs to be doing.
Maybe then one of the core values of an organization like that might be something like diversity of thought. Or
I like it.
You know.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Are there any core values that kind of resonate among everybody in the workforce? Like, all, you know, we talk about what millennials like this and boomers do this, and any values that kind of span all of those generations?
Interesting. Actually, there are 3. There was some research done 10, 15 years ago, where the researchers printed a list of a dozen values and asked type-alike groups from all different generations to force rank them in order of importance.
Okay.
And something interesting happened. The same 3 values were rated as the top 3 by all generations.
Mm-hmm.
They were in different order. They were manifested differently. But the core concepts were the same. And so these 3 values, if you, in your communication, in your interaction with your clients, in your interaction with your people, if you include these 3 values in some form, you're good no matter what age the people are. Here they are. And these aren't in the exact order, but these are the top 3. Family. People want to be part of a group.
Mm-hmm.
integrity. They want leadership that does the right thing. Mm-hmm. And love. They want to be rewarded in a way that they value for getting it right, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Belonging to a group, high integrity leadership, and being rewarded for getting it right. Those are the three that emerged across all generations.
Boy, and that's that. I mean, you know, we've heard all the stats here before about employee engagement. You know, 70% of American employees disengage in their jobs, just showing up. And then Gallup says, on the other hand, you know, companies with highly engaged workforces outperform their peers by 147% in earnings per share. And it sounds like the answer toward flipping that employee engagement issue on its head is those three things.
I mean, and if you want to do just one thing in 2019, if you want to do one thing this year, teach all of your supervisors or managers, anybody who manages, teach them active listening skills.
So important.
Start there.
So important.
If you only have budget or time for one class, that's it. Because if you're an introvert, you don't get out from behind your desk to go listen.
Right.
And if you're an extrovert, you're out there, but you're not listening.
No, you're thinking of what you're going to say next.
Yeah, that's right. And I have to do both things. I have to teach extroverts to shut up, and I have to teach introverts to get out from behind their desk. Mm-hmm. Let's invent a term. What's in the middle between extroverts and introverts?
Didn't somebody throw around the term ambivert at some point?
There you go.
I don't know if that's it or not, but it seems like I've heard that before.
There you go. I like that. that's the secret sauce.
Yeah, that is so important.
Now, let me jump briefly. I know we're...
We're good. We're good.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, both of our listeners need to...
I might have more than two.
I have low expectations. Five. You know, I have a great face for podcasting. This is a tough time for hiring because everybody is reporting a talent shortage. Mm-hmm. The pressure is on to lower your standards because you got to get the work done. Think of what we've learned about high performance. They're the crucial to the firm. They are very skittish. Somebody lies in an interview and promises that they're a high performer and you let them skate and you hire them. How quickly does the high performer know about the truth? Minutes, mm-hmm. days. How quickly are they offended that you're hiring? They want to work with people smarter than themselves.
Yeah. Yep.
I attended a presentation by General Colin Powell, and he brought this up. He said the leader of a unit has about 60 days to fix something like that. Mm-hmm. Or one of two things happens. Either the high performers peck the low performer to drive them out, or the high performer quits.
Yep.
Therefore, in hiring, raise your standards. Tell your people, we are not just filling this. I know it's more work for everybody. Would you rather we hold off and get the right person or hire anybody right now?
Right. And I would think that almost everybody would say, let's hold off.
Yeah. Or they'll come up with clever ideas on how to redistribute or, mm-hmm. hey, maybe we can postpone working on that until we get somebody, you know, blah, yep. blah, blah. But full transparency.
There's a hint of succession planning embedded in all this, isn't there? And everyone's talking about succession at this point and the future of their organizations. Eventually, you're going to want to turn it over to somebody who, who's a high performer, right?
This is where a firm should pull in an outside process expert to really work through what should the firm look like next, mm-hmm. and how do we get there, and do we have to change the team? Mm-hmm. That's where I know that Tom Hood and some of the other people on the BLI team do that type of planning. This is crucial. Because without that kind of a plan, you can't map the kind of people you're going to need, because the firm's going to change.
Yeah.
Happening on the horizon. Right? That's why the anticipatory firm, the anticipatory accountant, is crucial. We have to anticipate what's going to happen next. I'm a student of history. We are littered. I mean, Sears is in trouble. They used to be Amazon.
Yeah.
I understand American history. The people who ran canals did not expect railroads. You know, the world is changing, and we need to anticipate where we need to be and the type of people we would be hiring for that future world is different than the kind of people we have now. Yeah. And that's a cognizant decision to work with a strategic plan and somebody in talent management to start. You know, we need to start hiring people who can develop smartphone apps, because our clients are going to demand that. We want that in-house.
Okay. Yeah.
If we were leaving, if Bill, you and I were leaving right now and going to Hawaii, I can tell you at some point in that journey, we're going to have to change our vehicles. A car is not going to get us to Hawaii.
Right. Different vehicle.
Yep.
Yep. No, that's an excellent point, and I think a good one to kind of end on.
What? You're tired of me?
Not at all. In fact, I do have a couple follow-up questions on a personal note. You're a bit of a shutter bug, aren't you? How did that all get started?
I hated having my picture taken. And if you're behind the camera, you're safe.
You don't have to have that done. That's right.
Also, I love art. I love music. I have no abilities.
Yeah.
I can't draw. I can't sculpt. I just really admire the people that can. But I can run a machine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that gave me a role.
And you take some really interesting and beautiful photos.
Thanks.
I don't know. In an age where everyone's carrying a camera around in their pocket, does it seem like photography is becoming a bit of a lost art? Or
no, it's becoming. I love it.
Yeah.
It's become more accessible. In that, if you have a camera with you, you are subconsciously looking at the world differently. You are looking for pictures, and therefore you're more connected to the world. I'll tell you what is going to be the lost art in 100 years. Most of the pictures we are taking will never be seen again because they've been on a memory chip that they can no longer read.
That's one of my wife's big complaints is, you know, we're taking more photos than ever, and where are all my photos? You know, it's because you used to have photo albums full of them on the shelves.
That's right.
And now it's like, how can I find my photos? I don't know where they are anymore. And I think that's an interesting point.
So here's what I do. I have a printer, and every couple of weeks, I print the ones that bring me joy.
Mm-hmm.
And they become thumbtack art.
Yeah.
And they are then replaced by the next ones that bring me joy.
That's a great idea.
You know, printing paper's cheap and it's pretty archival. So I do that.
I think that's a great habit to get into. Otherwise, you know, the photos just get lost on your phone or in Facebook, wherever you put them, and after a while you forget they're even there. So that's a great point.
That's right.
Carl, it's always fun talking to you. I thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Oh, I was flattered to be asked. And of course, I'm always happy as any consultant. First off, if there's anyone out there that wants me to come to their firm, I'm a member of the BLI thought leader team, and I love coming on site, or if you want me to do what we're doing here, but just for your firm, I'm happy to book that also.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so much easier to tell you how to live your life than do a better job of living my own.
And you do that very well. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, Carl. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was Carl Ulrichs. He's a Business Learning Institute instructor and an expert on the people issues that challenge modern organizations. You can learn more about Carl at his website, which is expertspeaks.com, and also on the BLI's own website. That's blionline.org. Just click on course authors once you get there. Also, that book, Traction, that I mentioned, it's all about a business operating system called EOS, which is designed to help leaders get what they want from their businesses. And the BLI can help you implement that in your organization. Your team will become more disciplined, more accountable in how they work, and help you execute completely on your vision. You can learn more about that at strategyx.blionline.org. That's strategyx, as in x-ray, .blionline.org.